Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer reports on how a downturn in the economy is affecting local foundations and nonprofits. First, David Boren served as governor of Oklahoma in the 1970s and then served in the U.S. Senate for 15 years. He is now president of the University of Oklahoma. That unique perspective is the catalyst for a new book in which Boren outlines the challenges facing America and how they can be tackled. He is the guest tomorrow at the Kentucky Author Forum. Boren spoke with Stephanie Sanders about his book, Letter to America.
I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you about was pretty early in your book. It says, the signs of trouble are clear for all to see, and only those in deliberate denial could fail to notice, as you're outlining some of the problems our country is facing right now.
Right.
Do you think Americans are intentionally looking the other way?
No, I think not. You know, we live really busy lives, and unfortunately, I think too many of us don't take the time to read or to listen to detailed commentary that would help us understand what's going on in the world around us. I would say that it seems to be that only crises get our attention. And obviously what has happened in the financial community in just the last few days has gotten our attention. And I was thinking, I wrote this book roughly a year ago, and I was thinking about how much the situation has changed in this country in just that short time. I started out with the story of interviewing the finalists for the Rhodes Scholarship, these incredibly bright young people. And in the course of the interview, I asked them the question, how long do you think the United States will remain the greatest superpower in the world? And one by one, they just couldn't seem to answer that question. They were shocked by it, the thought that we won't always be the number one superpower in the world seemed to just astound them. They looked at me almost offended. And I was just thinking to myself the other day, in just a year, think how much things have changed. I think if you ask that question today, they would really be much more informed about how we've been slipping in terms of our economic power in the world, how we're only 6% of the world's population, how the cost of the war is affecting our domestic economy, a lot of other things that didn't seem to come to mind to them a year ago. So sometimes it takes a crisis. It takes a shock like we've had in the financial community in the last few days to cause us to really reflect about what we need to be doing in the long term to help our country.
And speaking of what's happening on Capitol Hill this week, there's a whole chapter of your letter named The Destructiveness of Partisanship. How do you see that playing out and what's happening this week on Capitol Hill, and how can lawmakers move past that?
Well, unfortunately, I wish I'd been wrong in my book, but I think that what we've seen the last week is just a glaring, the worst possible example of partisanship in the extreme, of people playing the blame game at a time when we're in desperate need of people coming together to solve the problem. And if we don't come together and come together quickly, we could see a repeat of 1929, 1930, 1931 in this country. Doesn't have to happen that way. We can still get together and prevent that, but we have to get together. And so in the book, I suggested two or three things. It's not enough just to talk about bipartisanship. You have to set up some institutions that cause it. When I first came to the Senate, and this was obviously several years ago, I remember Wendell Ford and Dee Huddleston, I believe, were the two senators from Kentucky at that time. And the new senators, half were Democrats and half were Republicans, 16 of us used to get together with our spouses and actually have potluck dinners at each other's houses about every 6 or 8 weeks. We became personal friends. We worked together. This doesn't happen anymore. You think about the old days when President Johnson and Everett Dirksen, the great Republican leader, used to get together after the day's end and maybe have a glass of wine together, and or maybe it was some Kentucky bourbon, and say, okay, we've had our fight. Now let's meet each other halfway and let's get this thing solved. We think after World War II, you think about the Marshall Plan, which literally, I think, more than anything else, may have impacted our victory in the Cold War, that made such a difference for almost half a century. that was the product of cooperation between President Truman and Secretary Marshall, who were Democrats, and Senator Vandenberg, the great Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They did it together. So I think we have to create some institutions, as I say in the book. One, whoever wins this presidential election, I hope they will appoint a truly bipartisan cabinet. Let's pick, like Lincoln did, pick the very best people without regard to party. And I don't mean, let's say a Democrat wins, okay, we're going to put one Republican in the cabinet just to look good, or vice versa. I mean, really have the cabinet split about 50-50 and the important posts in the cabinet, and get the very best qualified people we can to be in the cabinet. And the other thing I'd like to see is every 10 days, let's say, have small working groups, one maybe on the economy, maybe one's on national security and foreign policy. President sits at the head of the table, two or three critical cabinet members like the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Treasury, sit there with six or eight equal number Democrats and Republicans who are the real leaders in Congress on these subjects, and sit in the room and say, okay, we're going to work out bipartisan solutions to these kinds of problems. This isn't happening informally anymore, so we have to set up an institution to make it happen on a regular basis. And when people get together on a regular basis and sit next to each other, it's very unlikely they're going to get out and attack each other publicly nearly as much, and we'll finally get something done.
It seems like something, though, that would take a long period of time, because we're so deep into the bitter partisanship now.
Right. It is going to take some time. But, you know, we haven't been so deep in this partisanship as long as we think. As I say, when I first went to the Senate, it was, 1979. So that's been 25 to 30 years ago. So, in other words, this isn't something that has gone on. And even when I left the Senate in 1994, that's been 14 years ago, it was still a lot different. This isn't something that's been there for 100 years. The tradition of bipartisanship was there for almost 200 years. We've been away from it for maybe 20 years in an intense way. So I think we can rebuild it, but I don't think we can rebuild it just by saying, oh, we want bipartisanship back. No, it's going to take more than that. It's going to take creating these new institutions, these new working groups. It's going to mean creating a different kind of cabinet. It's really going to take a lot of hard work to make it happen, but just think, if we'd already been working on this for a year or two, and we had this group up and functional right now, I don't think we would have had happen what happened in the House of Representatives here recently, where just shockingly, as I look at it, the Congress was playing Russian roulette with the future of the American economy, and really, it shows the need to learn history, which is something else I talked about in the book. If we had people that really had read the history of what the crash of 1929 led to, they'll realize it wasn't just the people on Wall Street that got hurt. They were a small number compared to the millions and millions of innocent Americans, hardworking Americans out here in small businesses and on the farms, and all the other people, the 50% who became unemployed. So that's another thing. A good dose of rereading our history might help right now.
And you kind of led us back around to something I wanted to ask you about again, about sort of the financial meltdown that's happening in the country this week and over the last few months. In your chapter in your book about the economic health of the country, it talks about, you know, problems with national debt and Social Security and Medicaid spending and infrastructure needs and other things like that. Do you think those things have to take a back seat now that Congress is having to deal with the current financial meltdown?
Well, I think they'll have to take a back seat to a certain degree, and I think they're going to have to be some sacrifices made. But they can't totally take a back seat. For example, energy independence. We must, and rebuilding our infrastructure, we must do those things, or we're going to continue to just go further and further into debt to other countries especially. I mean, we're using 25% of the oil. We only have 3% of it. And if we drill, we're still going to be lucky to keep up to the 3-4% level. So there are times, even in some very tough times, when you still have to make some investments. I think one of the things you do is you pay for it by requiring some of those people to make sacrifices who, while the war has been going on in Iraq, for example, one of my students asked me one day, when have we ever cut taxes in the middle of a war? And the answer to that is never. And, of course, the main taxes we cut were for the top 1% of people with income in this country. Last year, their incomes went up over $1 million on the average. Last year, the top 0.1% went up $4 million on the average. So their take-home pay after taxes, they got a huge tax cut. 90% of the American people in the last couple of years have seen their incomes go down $2,000. So, you know, I think some of those people who can afford to make some sacrifices and could afford to put some money back in the till, and there are some of the people that were making the excessive salaries on Wall Street, for example, and bonuses, they need to put some money back in the till. And I think one of the ways we can think about it is distributing more fairly the tax burden, and so that we can begin to have energy independence, and we can start thinking about health care for all the people in our country. So, yes, we're going to have to be more frugal. Yes, we're going to have to make some more sacrifices. It's an old-fashioned word. People running for office don't like to tell people they have to make sacrifices. But in one way or another, all of us are going to have to make some sacrifices to get things back on track and to live more within our means.
Toward the end of the book, when you're kind of wrapping up some of these thoughts, there was one sentence that made me pause and read it a few times over again before I had to go on. It says, we must face the possibility that we could be the first generation of Americans that fails to contribute to the unbroken line of progress in our country.
Right.
I guess that strikes me because that is the opposite of the American dream, which is to make the country better for the next generation. Do you think Americans are just losing sight of that dream?
Well, I think that, again, part of it is we need to reread our history. David McCullough, the great historian, said not too long ago, a country can't remain great unless it knows how it became great in the first place. And half of our high school students last year graduating thought that we fought on the side of Nazi Germany in World War II. Ivy League graduates, these are only Ivy League colleges, a fourth of them thought the president had the right to suspend the Constitution at will, and the Bill of Rights. Unbelievable. So a part of it is we need to relearn our own history, and we also need to see how we've always risen to the challenges. Ultimately, I'm an optimist. I think if we really do get together in a bipartisan way, if I think that we really are willing to make sacrifices for our children and our grandchildren, I think we are. I think we look back at some of the ways we've done it in the past and succeeded, reread some of that history. One of the problems we got into was undoing all the reforms that Franklin Roosevelt put in place to keep us from being overextended in Wall Street and in the marketplaces. So I think in the end, yes, we can realize the American dream, not just for ourselves, but especially for our children and our grandchildren. But it's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take sacrifice, and we can do it. I still, with all the problems that I think we need to face, and that's one of the things we need to start being honest with each other. We need to quit watching so-called television news. It's nothing but entertainment that just feeds our prejudices. We need to be listening to thoughtful programs that are broadcast on stations like yours, where we really go into depth. We need to educate ourselves. And I still think we can do it, but we are at risk. We are definitely at risk. 6% of the population, we cannot be the leading nation in the world unless we're the best educated, best informed, to get every ounce of talent out of our people. And so that's the reason I felt obligated to write this book, saying to the American people, let's take a little time out from all of our entertainment, and let's have some serious conversations with each other about things that really matter and those things that are really going to determine our future.
All right, David Boren, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's former U.S. Senator David Boren. His book is Letter to America. He's the featured guest at the Kentucky Author Forum tomorrow night in Louisville. The turmoil on Wall Street has more than banks and businesses on alert. Foundations and nonprofits here in Louisville are bracing themselves for the fallout. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
It was just days after Lehman Brothers filed for the biggest bankruptcy case in U.S. history when the Association of Small Foundations held its annual conference. The association's Tim Walter took a survey of the attendees.
94% of them said that they felt the recent turmoil was more serious than previous shocks, such as the collapse of Enron, bursting of the dot-com bubble, or the decline following the 9/11 attacks. And actually, 84% of the respondents said that their endowments were down this year, some dramatically.
Louisville's foundations are considered small, but each year they give away millions of dollars to local nonprofit organizations. The current financial crisis has local foundations thinking about their investments and how nonprofits they support will weather the storm. Mason Rummel is paying close attention. She's with the area's largest foundation, the James Graham Brown Foundation.
We're going to sit and watch it, and we're going to keep talking to our managers about their strategies and why they're staying where they are.
Rummel and other local foundation leaders say these days they have conservative and highly diversified investment portfolios they hope can counter market shocks. But they point out that any sharp downturn will surely affect future grants. The news comes at a time when many arts and social service organizations are already dealing with substantial cuts in government funding. The Humana Foundation's Virginia Judd says that has implications for foundations.
There's been a reduction in state funding, and national resources are more limited. And so I think there's an expectation that foundations need to step up to the plate.
So how much money do local foundations give away? In 2007, the Brown Foundation gave more than $20 million, and the Humana Foundation gave more than $8 million. Actors Theater of Louisville and Brooklyn Child and Family Services both got money. Brooklawn has programs for emotionally troubled boys, and here Humana Foundation money underwrites drumming classes. Staff member Dennis Roach.
It helps teach discipline, and they enjoy coming in and doing it. And so they work hard, and they work on that level of working on themselves.
Brooklawn's president, David Graves, says that the agency has had to scale back in recent years because of cuts in government funding, and it's been a clarion call.
We've got to be more efficient. We've got to combine our resources to meet the growing needs. So we will be in dialogue with other agencies, a way of sharing operations, a way to collaborate.
In recent years, Brooklawn and other nonprofits have merged staff and programs. It's a strategy local foundations find encouraging, says the Brown Foundation's Mason Rummel.
The pressure's on now. And so the nonprofits are going to have to get very creative, because while we recognize what's happened in the whole philanthropic world, we can't make up for it, even as large as we are.
Leaders of local foundations and arts and social services say they will be working to tap into that creativity to deal with any future decreases in government and foundation funding that could cut into the bone of their core missions. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, Gabe Bullard interviews two people involved in the recently renewed debate over wine sales in grocery stores. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, Keeneland's fall meet started Friday. We'll have a look at what's ahead at the Lexington track. First, this year, a bill that would allow wine to be sold in Kentucky grocery stores died in the legislature. A group called the Food with Wine Coalition is pushing a revised version of the bill for the General Assembly to consider next year. Gabe Buller talked with its consultant, Luke Schmidt, about the coalition's goal.
What's the argument, or why is there a Food with Wine Coalition?
Well, the Food with Wine Coalition was created by Kentucky's food store operators to recognize the increasing demand that the food store operators were receiving from their customers in counties where alcoholic beverage sales are allowed by the package, or in other words, a wet county or a moist county. A lot of consumers were asking their food store operators, why can't we buy wine to have with our dinner? We're here to buy food and everything else that we need, and for whatever reason, we can't buy wine. And in Kentucky, at the present, the law does not allow food stores to sell wine. Secondly, wine has become an accepted part of a healthy, balanced diet. Lifestyles are changing, and The food store operators decided that perhaps now was the time to take a look at the law, which hasn't really been changed since Prohibition, to see if the opportunity might exist to change the law.
And what kind of resistance have you met?
Well, primarily, we started this effort last year. We took it through the most recent session of the General Assembly. And what we have found is that, for the most part, when people understand the message that we're bringing, they tend to support it. For one thing, we're only talking about changing this situation in wet counties or moist counties where alcoholic package sales are already allowed. This would have absolutely no impact whatsoever on a dry county. We respect the custom of local option. If a county is dry today and its voters wish to stay dry tomorrow, that's fine with us. We're not out to change that. Another thing that is important to note is 34 states already allow this practice. Six of our seven border states already allow food stores to sell wine. So we're not talking about something revolutionary or new. This has been done for years in many, many other states. And we just feel like it's time for Kentucky to step up and perhaps be a bit more progressive in this particular arena. Now, you asked about opposition. Liquor store operators are not necessarily thrilled with this because they frankly have had a monopoly on the sale of wine in the state for many, many years. Our response to that is that we feel that this will increase and expand the overall market for wine in the state. It will bring more shoppers for wine, not only to food stores, but also to liquor stores. And experience indicates that, for the most part, this should have a positive effect on the entire wine sales category.
And that it'll just excite more Kentuckians about wine.
Exactly.
What about the argument? In a previous story, I had talked with some liquor store owners, and they said their opposition, as they voiced it, towards selling anything beyond beer in grocery stores is that there's not the staff to check IDs, to do all that, and that you have underage people buying alcohol that is available in a convenience store or grocery store, and they don't think that that should be open for more liquors.
Well, that's really an argument that's pretty hollow in our opinion. First of all, food stores have been allowed to sell beer for many, many years. Beer is an alcoholic beverage. It's regulated and monitored just like any other alcoholic beverage is. The sales staff at a food store, those people are trained to spot fake IDs or underage purchasers, and they're trained what to do in response to that. This will be no different in terms of what they're already doing successfully and responsibly in terms of, okay, if a young person wants to sneak in and buy a bottle of Chardonnay, the cashier or the staff person at the food store is going to be knowledgeable about what to do. They will ask for the appropriate ID. If it's not given, they will not be allowed to purchase it. We absolutely support all of the existing laws and regulations about underage purchases, and because of the fact that food stores have successfully been selling beer and responsibly been selling beer all of these years, we feel very secure in the fact that we can also take on wine without any difficulty at all. That's a hollow argument.
As far as the health issue you'd mentioned goes, there have been more studies showing wine as being, in moderation, a healthy beverage. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's something that could be argued, since grocery stores are already selling beer in many areas, as beer not being as healthy, not being as,
well,
at least thought to be as healthy?
Right. That's not an argument that we would want to make. You know, our focus is to allow food stores the opportunity to sell wine, and probably another way to look at that is there are several benefits to changing the law. Not only expanding consumer choice, expanding competition, and making it easier and more convenient to purchase wine on the behalf of the consumer. Kentucky itself has a growing grape and wine industry that a lot of people are not aware of. At one time, Kentucky was the third largest grape-producing state in the United States, and that existed up until about the time of Prohibition. When that happened, all of the vineyards in the state were basically plowed under and stayed that way for a long, long time. With the switch to alternative crops from tobacco to something new, one of the things that the state has been promoting to farmers has been expanding into grapes. And it's been a very successful expansion. There are now vineyards planted in 86 of 120 counties. So it's not just a couple of spots here and there, it's statewide. And wineries have sprouted around the state. There are almost 50 wineries located in Kentucky that are making very good wine. And this is an opportunity, by expanding the sales outlets in the state, It's also an opportunity to promote Kentucky wine and to make Kentucky wine for purchase more accessible to more consumers. And the food store industry and the Food with Wine Coalition very much supports the opportunity to promote Kentucky wines, and we are and have been in dialogue with a number of wineries to see how we might partner and work together.
That was Food with Wine Coalition consultant Luke Schmidt. Shortly after the coalition began its media push, the Liquor Barn chain announced it would no longer sell some Kentucky-made wines. The owners argued that the winemakers were giving some of the sales proceeds to the coalition, and if wine were sold in grocery stores, it would hurt packaged liquor retailers. Liquor Barn has since lifted the embargo on those wines. Gabe Bullard also talked with Gordon Jackson, who owns Old Town Wine and Spirits in Louisville, about the Food with Wine Coalition and if its success would mean harder times for liquor stores.
I talked to one of their spokespeople, and he said that this would ultimately help the packaged liquor stores that sell fine wines by just getting people more into wine. Do you think that that's a valid case?
I think it's a possibility. I think it's a fairly remote possibility. I think that people that are serious about wine typically want to go somewhere where there's large wine inventories and a staff that is very familiar and well-versed and understands food and wine. And in general, I think that it's more likely that a shop like us may drive their business.
So they would stand to benefit not only from, obviously, legislation allowing them to sell wine, but then also by having more people who are more interested in wine. They might be more curious picking up a bottle at, say, Kroger?
I'm not really sure. I think that's a little bit of a crystal ball thing. I don't have one.
All right.
I think that, certainly if you look at this market, I think the wine consumer's well served. I don't think there's a shortage of outlets for fine wine in this market.
In the Louisville market or in Kentucky in general?
In the Louisville market.
And in a past interview with you, you'd said about being able to sell not just wine, but wine and spirits in grocery stores, that it's more of that there's not really the staff there that can be able to handle it, that they might be too young, they might not really know some of the tricks that people might use to try to get liquor underage. They might have friends who are underage trying to get it. Do you think that would still be the case with wine, with just wine and beer available at grocery stores?
Certainly. I think that the problem with the sale of alcohol to minors is I think that the grocery stores certainly have an issue with the sale of alcohol to minors.
In that it happens?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's easier, like if, let's say someone were 20 years old, do you think they'd have an easier time buying beer at the Value Market a couple blocks from Old Town or at Old Town?
I would like to think that they would not stand a very big chance at all of buying alcohol at Old Town because, we see a lot of kids come in and out of here, and we ask for a ton of IDs.
Are there any other steps you take besides carding to keep alcohol out of the hands of minors?
Yeah, absolutely. We watch, we have homeless people that come in and out of here and that attempt to buy alcohol for minors. We watch our parking lot, and as much as there may be a car with a carload of kids and one person of age, and that one person walks in our shop and buys two or three things, we're looking in the parking lot to find out if there's a bunch of kids waiting.
And that's something you don't think grocery stores are prepared to handle?
I think they could be. I think that it's definitely not their main focus, where here that we know that 99% of what we sell is product with alcohol, and we're very, very concerned and conscientious about it.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with Gordon Jackson, the owner of Old Town Wine and Spirits in Louisville. Shortly after banning some Kentucky-made wines, the Liquor Barn chain lifted its restriction. Keeneland, which attracts spectators and horses from around the world, launched its Fall Meet Friday. As Charles Compton reports, the historic Lexington track is pulling out the stops in hopes of countering a tumultuous economy.
Irrespective of economic meltdowns, presidential politics, and foreign wars, horses run. Thoroughbreds are already running at Keeneland, where morning workouts prepare them for the fall meet. The 17-day event brings racehorses to Lexington from the Americas and Europe. Rogers Beasley is Keeneland's director of racing.
We're very unique in the sense that we're one of the few racetracks in America that actually get horses coming from Europe outside for the Breeders' Cup. For example, this morning there are two horses out here on the grounds, Lord Admiral and Lovelace, both of whom will be running in the Shadwell Mile on Saturday. We also have a two-year-old colt who's come over to run in the Woodford Reserve.
When they run, they'll run on the relatively new polytrack surface. The artificial track is among the safest in North America. Over the summer, Keeneland President Nick Nicholson adds they saw no accidents. After the deaths of Barbaro and Eight Bells, the industry's safety record is under considerable scrutiny.
We're having this interview trackside a couple hours after three-quarters of an inch of rain hit, and these horses are going on it like it's a fast, dry racetrack. So the safety factors have been dramatically improved by this surface, and I'm proud that we were talking about it years ago. This is not a Johnny-come-lately thing for us.
The polytrack's been in place for a couple of years, but it has its critics. They say the track slows down a horse and complicates the task of picking a winner. In response, Keeneland upgraded its website this summer. Now the website provides handicappers with data on how a specific horse performs on an artificial surface. If Keeneland is to thrive, Nicholson says they must protect horse racing's intellectual aspects while making it more accessible.
And the web has given us a chance in an unprecedented way to compile data and share data. Just category after category after category, we're able to keep statistics and make them available to everyone.
Keeneland will also promote itself with special events. The families of military personnel get in free on October 19th. On the 10th, the track gives scholarships to college students. And on October 24th, they'll help in the fight against cancer by celebrating Pink Day. But even with promotional events, a new website, the Polytrack, and top horses, there's a good chance Keeneland's fall meet will be a disappointment. The poor economy could cut attendance. And even if turnout is good, Nicholson adds, less money could be spent at the track's restaurants, saloons, and betting windows.
Logic would say that it probably will have a negative impact. The people are being careful what they do. Perhaps the people will come out and be a little more subdued in their spending, which seems to be a pattern going on around the country this summer. So what we're going to do is worry about the things that we've got some control over.
Still, Keeneland is making big plans for its future. For the first time, it's working on a master plan. Nicholson says everything, from the tree-shaded parking lot to the Hunter Green grandstand, will be on the table. Nicholson says it'll be a long process. The trick, he says, is balancing Keeneland's potential with its traditions. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
When we come back, Tony McVeigh reports on the Governor's Arts Awards handed out last week. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about a new Lincoln exhibit at the Kentucky History Center in Frankfort. First, Kentucky's most prestigious arts awards have been handed out in ceremonies in the rotunda of the state capitol. Among those attending the annual event was Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh.
They're called the Governor's Awards in the Arts, and there are 9 of them. They honor individuals, businesses, and organizations that make significant contributions to the arts in the Commonwealth. Governor Beshear says the importance of the arts in education should never be underestimated.
Both the Arts Education Partnership and the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities have found that students who are highly engaged in the arts perform better in school and are more active in their communities.
Beshear says the arts can transform communities.
Paducah's artist relocation program took 70 artists from 17 different states and rehabilitated a blighted, drug-infested neighborhood.
And Beshear says an active arts community can be a boon to economic development.
Our Cabinet for Economic Development says that one of the top 10 questions they get from businesses considering relocating in Kentucky is this: What kind of arts amenities are available in this community?
He's one of the most incredible musicians I've ever been on the same stage with.
The Artist Award recognizes lifetime achievement in the arts, and this year's recipient is Vince DiMartino, professor of music at Center College in Danville.
I really thank all the high school bands and orchestras in the state that I was lucky enough to perform with. We've had some wonderful times together. Traveled all over the country with some of these bands talking about Kentucky and music in Kentucky.
John Timmons, who started the Louisville alternative record store Ear Ecstasy in 1985, is this year's Business Award winner.
I don't take it lightly, but let me see if I get this straight. You give a business award to somebody that started their business with a $500 cash advance on their MasterCard and a record collection. Okay. And you give a business award to somebody that's still in the record business.
One of the primary things that we are trying to do here now is to preserve our history and preserve our cultural arts, because they're dying. They're becoming a thing of the past.
That's Carol Eisen of the Cowan Community Action Group in Whitesburg, winners of this year's Folk Heritage Award. The nonprofit community service organization offers classes in old-time music, square dancing, and storytelling. The Kentucky Repertory Theater at Horse Cave won this year's Community Arts Award. Julianne White of Owensboro is this year's Education Award recipient. The City of Covington won the Government Award. Charlie Hughes of Nicholasville won the Media Award. This year's National Award winner is Kentucky-born playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks of Santa Monica, California.
She is the first and only African-American female to win a Pulitzer Prize for her play on Broadway, Top Dog Underdog. And I knew that I had to nominate her for this prestigious Kentucky Award, and my students agreed.
That's Lundiana Thomas of the African-American Theater Program at the University of Louisville, who spoke for Parks, who was unable to attend. The highest honor went to Owsley Brown II of Louisville, who won the Milner Award for Outstanding Philanthropic Contributions to the Arts. Each of the honorees received a small figurative sculpture carved by Louisville artist William Duffy. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
The Derby City Film Festival makes its debut this week with dozens of entries. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Chris Rommel, one of the festival's founders and organizers. Rommel says he wanted a festival that showcased the work of Louisville filmmakers alongside that of other independent filmmakers.
Why did you launch the Derby City Film Festival?
I had always thought about starting a film festival in Louisville just because there isn't a large-scale film festival. There's only genre-oriented ones. We just want a film festival that shows all different types of films and not just one specific genre. I always wondered why Louisville doesn't have a film festival like this. Every other city in the country, Nashville, Chicago, New York, Atlanta, they all have large international film festivals that have been going on for 15, 20, 25 years. Louisville doesn't have one that's been going on for any longer than a year or two and then is defunct. The Bluegrass Film Festival, which was out in Oldham County the last 2 years, it's now no longer. So hopefully this will last more than any of the other film festivals that have been attempted. There used to be a Derby City Film Festival, and it is now defunct, like all the other large film festivals that Louisville has tried to have over the last 20 years. We've run into a lot of people that have told us about film festivals at the Water Tower, other film festivals downtown that used to take place 15, 20 years ago that are no longer. But this is the first year, this is the inaugural year of the Derby City Film Festival.
What kind of work defines this festival?
It's basically an international film festival now. We have films from other countries as well as other states in the country and 19 films from Louisville. We're trying to go with truly independent films. And over the last 10, 15 years, the view of what an independent film is has been skewed by what I like to call indie wood films. Juno, great film, cost $15 million. I personally don't consider a film that cost $15 million independent. Once you get above the $1 million or so range, some sort of special financing through people that are associated with studios or distribution companies are involved. I mean, it's just a simple fact. Very few multi-million dollar films are funded like most of the independent films we're showing, which is credit cards, loans from family, other sources, because these are the people that, not saying that the people that make multi-million dollar films aren't as passionate as the people that don't have multi-million dollars, but it's just a different way of viewing what is independent. So the films that we're wanting to look at are, and that are screening, are probably less than, you know, you're not going to probably find them anywhere else other than screening in Louisville at the film festival. You, they may get DVD distributions either because of the festival or because they go to other festivals, but the films that we're screening, you're probably not going to find at other places. Whereas, you know, you can go find, you know, Juno, that went to, you know, 15 film festivals, that went, you know, wide release. A lot of the documentaries, you know, Fahrenheit 9/11 is one of the classic examples of a independent film. That's not really an independent film.
What are some of the films that viewers can see, and why and how did you choose them?
Well, we received over 400 submissions for the festival. We don't charge a screening or admission fee for the films that we screen, which is something we're trying to do differently than most other film festivals, that they charge you $35 just to see your film and then reject your film or accept the film. But the films that we're screening, 19 of them are from Louisville. Two of the, I believe, world premieres are from Louisville. One is Before I Say Goodbye, which was done by the Brothers Flores. It's about a war veteran who comes back from Iraq and reuniting with his friends, and, you know, the trials and tribulations that he goes through personally with trying to re-enter, you know, his collective. Another one is a film from a filmmaker who's from Louisville but now lives and shot his film in Philadelphia, Nicholas Gray. It's called If You Can Say It in Words. And it's a film about an artist who has Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism, but he's undiagnosed. And it's kind of a love story about his problems with being in a relationship because he is undiagnosed. And as most people that do have autism, it's very undiagnosed. I mean, it's one of the more common undiagnosed diseases. It's a very poignant film, and it's the world premiere that's here. And he's done a really good job with that. And then we have 38 short films.
Do you plan on repeating this again next year? And what are some things that you've learned about putting on a festival that you might do differently next year?
Well, even though the film festival hasn't started, we already have plans for changes for next year. We already have the dates scheduled for next year. It'll be October 14th through the 18th of next year. This year's kind of a test market. The Louisville Memorial Auditorium that we're holding the festival in seats 1,800 people. Now, when I originally planned the festival, we had it at the Clifton Center, the iFloor Theater, which holds about 470. It's different. Having 100 people per screening is kind of what we're shooting for. There's 25 screenings, so that would be 2,500 people to attend the festival, which, you know, we think is a pretty good number for a first-year film festival of any kind. However, if we get 100 people only per screen, 100 people in an 1,800-seat auditorium doesn't look as full as 100 people in a 480-seat auditorium. So the number of people will just depend upon our location. As far as the venue, we've been very frugal with our budget as far as our equipment and location. So we've definitely planned for at least a five-year run. And hopefully it'll bring Louisville the recognition that it deserves but doesn't have for the film community.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Chris Rama, one of the founders of the Derby City Film Festival, which opens Wednesday. The celebration of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial continues this month with the opening of a new exhibition at the Thomas D. Clark Center for Kentucky History in Frankfort. It's called Beyond the Log Cabin, Kentucky's Abraham Lincoln. I spoke with Marilyn Zoidis, Assistant Director of the Kentucky Historical Society, about the exhibition. Well, tell me a little bit about the exhibit. This has been a long time coming, hasn't it?
We have been thinking Lincoln for a long time here at the Kentucky Historical Society. The exhibition has been in development for 2 years and will premiere for the public October 21st here at the Center for Kentucky History in Frankfort.
So this is called Beyond the Log Cabin, Kentucky's Abraham Lincoln. How did you come up with the title?
Well, that's an interesting story. story, we actually met with all of our staff people and told them the broad ideas for the exhibition. And someone actually in our PR marketing area came up with the title, because we wanted to say that this exhibition was going to explore pieces of Lincoln's life that were little known, his relationship to Kentucky and Kentuckians that had not been explored before. While many people know Abraham Lincoln was born in a log cabin, that's only a small part of the story. So the exhibition looks beyond the stereotype of Abraham Lincoln to what we think are important themes for his life and for our lives today.
Of course, he moved, his parents and family moved away when he was young, but he never forgot his Kentucky roots, did he?
He never did, nor his Kentucky friends. And that's the point we really hope to make, that he was in communication with his Kentucky friends. And, of course, his wife was from Lexington, and she had her family still in the state. So those roots remain deep. And, of course, psychologists will tell you that the formative years of our lives are so key to those values that we use the rest of our lives. So those first 7 years he had in Kentucky were very important.
Of course, one of his best friends lived in Louisville, Joshua Speed, correct?
Indeed. He really treasured that friendship, and they remained in correspondence. And then he named James Speed as his attorney general, his second attorney general. So again, that connection with Speed is important. And in the exhibition, we will have the official commission that Abraham Lincoln signed, naming James Speed as the attorney general of the United States.
What else will people see when they attend?
Well, we're very excited to have some unique artifacts that we have collected from museums, historical repositories across the country. We have a piece of embroidery that was done by Mary Todd Lincoln. It was done while she was in the White House, but these are skills that she learned as a young girl in Lexington. Of Lincoln's personal artifacts, we have a razor that he used. This is, of course, before he grew his famous beard. A walking stick that he used, as well as his pocket watch. We have family pieces from the Todd family, as well as a table that was attributed to Thomas Lincoln. That is from a private collection being lended to the organization. Loaned, I suppose I should say. Loaned to the organization, sorry.
Now, this will be on display at the Center for Kentucky History in Frankfort for a while, and then it's, I understand, going kind of on the road a little bit, huh?
We're very pleased to be able to have this exhibition travel to different parts of Kentucky. Two traveling venues are the Speed Art Museum in Louisville, and it will be there from June 28, 2009 to September 6, 2009. Another venue will be the Highlands Museum and Discovery Center in Ashland, and it will be there from October 2, 2009 till February 19, 2010. We have been so gratified by the response that we have had from historic sites throughout Kentucky, as well as the nation, to gather together for the first time this unique array of Lincoln-related materials and have them available for the people of Kentucky in what we think is going to be an extraordinary exhibition.
People are just fascinated with Lincoln, it seems like, now more than ever.
Well, I think in a presidential year that the values that we look for in a president and that we see in Abraham Lincoln resonate with people today.
Marilyn Zoidis with the Kentucky Historical Society, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.